Ask an Astronomer is part of the Jodcast. For the full show, go to www.jodcast.net.
Hello, I'm Ian Morris, and I normally do the night sky part of the Jodcast, but today I'm actually going to be asking the astronomer the questions. So to start with, we have two that basically have a similar answer. The first is from Martin Ellis, and the second from someone just called Edward. And the first question was this. It was sent on the night of the 19th of the 4th, 07. Can you please tell me what the bright star-like shape is that, if you're looking at the moon, it's about 10 o'clock on a clock face? My wife thinks it's Venus. And the second question from Edward, between 20 and 21 hours BST, I assume, I see a bright star in the west which is moving from south to north. What is it? So, Tim, what do you think this is?
Well, hello, Ian. Thank you for stepping in for Nick, who's away in New Zealand at the moment. I think, actually, Martin Ellis ought to probably congratulate his wife on getting the right answer, because I suspect the answer is that it's Venus.
Spot on.
Yeah. So it's been very bright recently, you know, as a sort of evening star, basically, looking like a very bright star in the evening sky as it darkens. So, yeah, it's basically... More often than not, it's a very common question, this, isn't it, that we get asked, actually, on clear nights, is what's this incredibly bright thing in the sky? And more often than not, the answer is Venus. Even the second questioner, Edward, saying that he sees a bright star in the west, which is moving from south to north, I think it was you that pointed this out, that of course, because it would be setting, that planet itself would be moving sort of farther to the west, if you like, which if you're looking in the western direction would be effectively south to north.
That's absolutely right. We had lots of phone calls during a period in April when the skies were very clear at night, and someone said they thought Venus and the Moon, I think on the same night, in fact, as you'd seen it, Martin, looked just a bit like the Turkish flag, which has a crescent and a star.
Oh, that's right, yeah.
It really did look lovely. In fact, this last... few weeks and continuing up to the beginning of June, in fact, Venus is higher in the sky, or as high in the sky as we ever see it.
Right.
Previous time it was visible in the evening, in fact, it was very low, it wasn't nearly so obvious, but I can even see it from my back garden and have a lousy western horizon, so that's pretty good.
I can vouch for his western horizon, it's very poor. Probably the other thing to say, I guess, is just to remind people again about how they might discover the answers to these questions themselves, actually.
Absolutely.
I mean, of course, we welcome them sending in the questions to us, but there's several websites on which you can find some software. Of course, there's Ian's Night Sky that will tell you a little bit about things, but there's also software that you can download. So, for example... Stellarium, which is free software. Cardusiel is another one. Celestia.
Exactly. Yes.
There's several software packages which are free to download, and which will tell you exactly what these things are in the night sky from your location at whatever time you happen to be observing. So worthwhile checking those out, I would say. Another website that's really useful is Heavens Above.
Yes.
www.heavens-above.com, I think it is. Which tells you, not only does it have information about what's up and about in the night sky at any given time, it also gives you predictions for when you'd be able to see satellites, like the International Space Station and these Iridium flares. These, you know about those, don't you, Ian?
Yes, in fact, we had a Macclesfield Astronomy Society meeting here just a couple of weeks ago, and the chairman said we're going to see an Iridium flash at 10 minutes to 10. Actually, it was 09:54 and 30 seconds, I think, up in the northeast, and it arrived spot
bang on.
And it looked very bright. The first time I saw one of those, I thought it might be a supernova. Just two other little comments about Venus I find interesting. The first is that as it becomes nearer to the Earth, it obviously gets larger in angular size.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, the amount of the surface we see illuminated gets less. It becomes a crescent. And these two factors cancel out. So the brightness of Venus stays pretty well constant at about -4 for about 3 or 4 months. So that's one interesting thing. And the other comment, of course, is it was the fact that Galileo Galilei was able to see that Venus could have an almost full phase, which basically proved that the Copernican theory was right. If, as in the Ptolemaic system, Venus rotated in orbit between the Earth and the Sun, it would always be backlit.
That's right.
But of course, yeah. If it goes around the sun, you can see it on the far side, and yeah. then that's when you can get a full phase.
Yeah.
Okay, the next question we have comes from Stephen Uiti, we believe. He says this: extrasolar planets are mostly found by looking at the star's wobble, which is caused by the planets in orbit around it. But he points out many stars are variable. The sun is, to some extent. So as a star expands and contracts a bit, that will also shift the spectral lines. So how can we distinguish between this effect and the movement due to a planet? It's a very, very searching question.
Yeah, so this is a good question, actually. It's been something that's been mentioned in the past, of course, is that really the problem is that when we detect these planets by what's called Doppler wobble, what we're talking about is that as the planet orbits the star itself is orbiting. In fact, they're both orbiting the common centre of mass. So the star sort of wobbles around and around this sort of common centre of mass. And it's possible to take very high precision spectra of the star, to split the light into a spectrum and look at the basically the variations in the spectrum due to the absorption of light by atoms and molecules in the atmosphere of the star. Look at the fact that those are basically shifted backwards and forwards in the spectrum, so from sort of the red to the blue and back again, as the star moves towards us, causing a shift to the blue, and as the star moves away from us, causing a shift to the red, basically Doppler shift, blue shift and red shift. So what Stephen's asking is it possible to disentangle the effect of stellar pulsation from this Doppler wobble? Because he's sort of imagining, you know, if the star expands and contracts, then at one point when the star's expanding, the atmosphere of the star is moving towards us, and that might result in a blue shift, of course. And then when it contracts, it moves away from you, results in a red shift. So how can you tell the difference between the two things? First thing to say probably is that those sorts of simple pulsations, as described there, so-called radial pulsations, where the radius of the star is changing, would actually generally result in a brightness variation. So it's possible to check for a sort of correlation between these Doppler shifts seen in the spectrum and the brightness of the star. And typically that you know, for these stars, for these putative extrasolar planets orbiting these particular stars, that correlation doesn't exist. So often it's fairly straightforward to sort of exclude the possibility of pulsation in that simple way. However, there was sort of early on in the story of discovering extrasolar planets by this technique, there was a bit of a debate that was, there's a famous paper by a gentleman called David Gray, an astronomer called David Gray, who pointed out that his observations of 51 Peg, which was the first solar type star to have planets found by this, orbiting planets found by this Doppler wobble technique, he pointed out that his observations showed that the shapes of these so-called absorption lines, the features in the stellar spectrum that are caused by absorption from atoms in the atmosphere, the shapes of these profiles, these lines, was changing with the same period as the putative planet was orbiting the star. So he was saying, actually, it's a confusion. There's something happening here where there's so-called non-radial pulsations. There's some sort of complicated sort of oscillation of the star, which results in the shapes of the lines changing with this period. And that when the astronomers who do the Doppler variations measure it, they're confused by that change in shape, and they interpret it as a Doppler profile caused by the star moving towards and away from us. So, you know, that caused quite a bit of debate over a period of a year or so at the time. And really that's gone away now, because not long after, in fact, there was a paper published the following year in 1998 by the same author, by David Gray, and there were others as well, where he basically redid his observations and found that signal had gone away. So, in fact, there was no longer any evidence for those line profile changes. So, you know, in that particular case, it seems that, you know, that was, in effect, his explanation was that it was basically a one in a few hundred chance that his original observations were wrong by chance, by sort of noise in the observations, and that he was unlucky, and that was basically what had happened with the original observations. However, people are very careful. Astronomers are very careful, of course, to exclude all these sorts of possibilities, and they're always looking at carefully at correlations between the Doppler variations and, say, the brightness, or even the, you know, other indicators due to the, you know, from these various lines that are in there that would be usually tied to oscillation. And an example of that is the sort of, you know, the magnetic cycle of a star. So, you know, the Sun has an 11-year, or perhaps more accurately, a 22-year cycle in its, you know, the number of sunspots, and it's all to do with the magnetic field of the Sun. That itself can actually cause a signature similar to that which would be found in these Doppler variations. So it's important to for those sort of long time scale variations that might mask, say, a Saturn-like planet or something. It's important to look for these other correlations with particular lines that such a magnetic cycle would give, and so that you can exclude that possibility. And that's basically what's done. I think probably just to finish off with, it's probably worth pointing out now, of course, that finding planets by radial velocity by this Doppler wobble technique is not the only way it's done. It is the majority of planets that have been discovered that way, but it's certainly not all of them now. And if you look at, say, the Extrasolar Planets Encyclopedia, which you can find on the web, it's maintained by an astronomer called Jean Schneider at the Paris Observatory, then you'll find that that encyclopedia currently says that there are 235 candidate planets, 223 planets that would have been detected by radial velocity, that there's 19 planets have had a transit detected. So also, you know, some of that overlaps. So, for example, if a planet passes in front of its parent star, then the brightness of the background star is going to be, some of it's going to be blocked, and so you get a dip in the brightness. And of course, you know, that's a completely independent method to this radial velocity technique. There's also microlensing, where gravitational microlensing, where the light from a planet star system actually focuses the light from a background star, lenses it, gravitational lensing, sort of Einstein's prediction. There's been four planets found that way thus far, according to that encyclopedia. And there's a number of planets been detected by imaging. There's also planets been detected by looking at pulsar timing. So there's a number of different ways it's done. So, you know, it's not, you know, although the majority are radial velocity, it's by no means the only way it's done. And probably just the last point is to look at, there's a new satellite that was launched relatively recently called CORO, or CORO, the acronym CORROT, which is stands for Convection, Rotation and Transits, which is, it's a mission that's a collaboration between the French Space Agency and partners in the European Space Agency and various countries in Europe and also Brazil. It's basically looking at asteroseismology, so the sort of, you know, oscillations of stars, and also searching for planets by transits, by the sort of, as the light brightness of the star varies. And it's really interesting looking at some of the first results which were announced recently, very recently. They've found the first planet transiting its parent star with a period of 1.5 days. Lovely, gorgeous, high accuracy photometry measuring the brightness. Beautiful observations. And also some observations of, you know, of oscillations. So it shows, for example, looking at high accuracy photometry of a star like the Sun, and seeing the sort of the oscillations you get, and typically you get these sorts of modes of oscillation of varying frequencies, so varying periods are present as different types of oscillation, you know, just like when you strike a bell, you get all these different modes of oscillation and frequencies going on at the same time, you get the same thing in a star. And this satellite showing, you know, lovely results, and clearly sort of being able to distinguish between these different effects. But it is a problem. It is certainly something that you can't dismiss lightly. You've got to be very careful in your interpretation of your observations, and that's basically what astronomers do.